The main event for this session, of course, is Lee Wengraff. Lee is a socialist and writer from New York City. She has written extensively on the topic of imperialism and colonialism for a range of publications, including Socialist Worker, the International Socialist Review, and Jacobin magazine. And most significantly, she is the author of this excellent book, Extracting Profit, Imperialism, Neoliberalism, and the New Scramble for Africa. This is, as far as I know, one of only two copies that remain at the conference. They're very hot ticket items. But it's also, an excellent read. So Lee will speak for about 45 minutes, and then we'll get to the discussion section. So please join me in welcoming Lee Wengraff.
Hi, comrades. So glad to be here. It's my first trip to Australia, so really glad to be able to attend this conference. Just to warn you, I'm a little hopped up on cold medicine, so if I'm speaking too fast or saying something that's incomprehensible, just kind of do this to me or something like that, or Vanilla will help me out if I just kind of ramble on too quickly. So anyway, I just want to start to say by saying that I'm sure I speak for everyone in this room who are, I'm sure, all of us electrified and inspired by the uprising in the Sudan and celebrating the fall of dictator Omar el-Bashir last week, as well as the fall of Bouteflika in Algeria. I think it's momentous and fantastic timing that we're here as socialists and radicals and to be able to lift this up and celebrate this revolutionary upheaval. I've been trying to follow the situation in Sudan very closely, and the inspiration of the resilience of the union of workers and unions and everyone who've been in the street, the Sudanese Professional Association, and masses of crowds are continuing to sit in and protest the military government, and they declared recently, "Today we continue the march to finish the victory for our victorious revolution. We assert that our revolution is continuing and will not retreat or deviate from its path until we achieve our people's legitimate demands of handing over power to a civilian government." So these are long-standing dictators that have been brought, decades-long dictators who have been brought down by massive upheavals, rulers who have represented massive repression and immiseration, such that I think what we're really seeing is the opening up of a new chapter of the Arab Spring, but really I think a new chapter that can rightfully be called an African Spring as well, because not only in the Sudan and in Algeria and so on, just over the past few weeks, large numbers of people have been taken to the streets in South Africa and also in Zimbabwe, Nigeria, and beyond. So much as the Western media would like us to think that this is just the products of resistance to African dictators, as I'll get into, very importantly also a response to the forces of neoliberalism and imperialism that have helped create the widespread poverty to militarize the continent and devastate the environment that's been happening over the continent for decades. So I'm going to return a little towards the end to the latest developments in the Sudan and some of the significance of that. But I just wanted to sort of start our discussion with the immense importance of these struggles and the urgency of a vision of internationalism and our solidarity. So today's, I would argue that today's explosion from below, the ones that I've sort of started to highlight, is really evolving in an important new sort of chapter in a context of a plunder of Africa on the part of multinationals. And this is for oil, industrial metals, minerals, unprecedented levels of economic growth and so on, and vast profits for multinationals and African elites. And this really started around the turn of this millennium when there was just high commodity prices like oil and all the others that I mentioned generated really a frenzy of natural resource extraction. And fuel and mineral exports from Africa have reached into the hundreds of billions of dollars, which now at this point far exceeds the amount of foreign aid that's coming into the continent. And so, I mean, what you're seeing really is a plunder by the world's largest corporations, all the household names that we know of, Exxon, Shell, and so on, European, Australian multinationals, have created a dynamic where there's incredible polarization and enrichment at the hands of investors, ruling classes, international capital, but have also created a very sharp class polarization and poverty in Africa today. And I'll get into some of those specifics. It's really also, just to kind of step back, it's not difficult to see that, and anyone who's just kind of even read a little bit about what this new scramble for Africa looks like, you can really see the echoes in terms of the contradictions and the poverty and devastation, kind of the echoes of earlier chapters of a very long and sordid history of exploitation from the slave trade and, of course, the colonial scramble for Africa. And the conditions that we're seeing today are really sort of laid on that, that's the sort of historical roots that I think we have to understand. And just as in the past, where exploitation of labor and natural resources have dominated African economies, we are really seeing very much a similar dynamic today. But earlier chapters, now Western foreign rulers and so on can sort of step back and say, well, we've paid the debts for those past eras. And there's really the dominant world leaders like to sort of say that this era is closed, from, you know, the Christine Lagarde, who's the head of the IMF, to, you know, certainly Trump, and so on, and that really that any debts have been paid. And where I think for us on the left, we have to have a radically different starting point that's probably obvious to everyone in this room. And one of the writers that's been the most inspiring and interesting to me in understanding this is the Guyanese revolutionary Walter Rodney. Is anyone here familiar with Walter Rodney? And he wrote an amazing book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And he was actually assassinated in 1981 by the Guyanese police. But I encourage people to look into his history. And Verso Books just re-released all of his work. Anyway, he describes a situation like this. He says, the operation of the imperialist system bears major responsibility for African economic retardation, that's his word, by draining African wealth and by making it impossible to develop more rapidly the resources of the continent. So really he's sort of laying the blame at the feet of colonialism. So in other words, in any attempt to understand the underdevelopment, as Rodney calls it, must situate the conditions firmly in this past, but I would argue extend this all the way through the neoliberal era and what's called the new scramble for Africa today. So just to get into a little bit more details about what this looks like. So as I mentioned, the first decade of the century, oil prices tripled, commodity prices jumped by 400% worldwide. Africa actually possesses about 10% of the world's oil, so this is something not everybody is familiar with. So obviously with this huge surge of prices, this had a major impact on economic growth. So you saw in Africa at that time GDP rates of about 5 to 6%, which is had been virtually unprecedented on the continent. Trade between Africa and the rest of the world during this time is, again, past 15 years, increased 200%. Which is obviously quite massive, and there was a decline in foreign debt by about 25%. So this was, I don't know if people have seen, like the business presses just went kind of mad about this, and there was talk about a rising Africa, a new day is dawning, and this sort of idea that now, because of these rising GDPs and this growth of wealth, that this would then mean an end of poverty, so to speak, or they promised, and a new African middle class. And a part of what I try and do in the book is to kind of debunk a lot of this in terms of the actual, and I'll touch on some of this, but what actually happened to that and how that was really very much a myth. So, but what I want to talk about right now is what happened? Where did this come from? And there's really two factors that I want to talk about that really converged and created these conditions. And the first is the rise of China as a huge buyer of African commodities, and also the neoliberal prying open of African economies of the prior era, with its and all the privatization and austerity and deregulation that went with that. So, first of all, to start with China, the boom in China's economy and probably I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the massive industrial development, the growth in China. But also the other so-called emerging economies in Asia and Latin America spurred a major drive for new sources of energy and markets. And so Africa became very important in this. The foreign investment, what's called FDI, jumped at this time. And just to sort of get a sense of this, China uses approximately one-third of the world's steel, 40% of the cement, 40% of the entire world supply of copper, and is expected by next year to be the world's largest oil importer. So China's footprint can literally be seen across huge swaths of the continent. And this process involves not just drilling, mineral rights, and so on, but it's a political project as well. So it's about cementing political allegiances, alliances with with African regimes through infrastructure programs, dams, roads, bridges. In fact, two-thirds of Africa's infrastructure is now funded by Chinese companies. Leaders of particularly African oil-rich nations have really, at least initially, have very much welcomed this. And there's these kind of oil, what's common is oil for infrastructure barter deals where African nations can get, a bridge built or a dam built, but to repay that, it's a promise of future oil revenues. And this, of course, can be the basis for crises, which I'll get into. So the role of China is so developed in Africa that now loans from China have surpassed that of the World Bank and the IMF, which I think is really significantly. But to move from just China, but really like the role of the West and Western neoliberalism in this process is incredibly important. And I just want to sketch out a super brief history here, which is starting in the immediate post-colonial history. And I'm not going to be able to get into sort of pre-independence period, but just in the new period of independence in the 1960s, initially many African nations sort of launch into independence with relatively decent growth rates. There was increased spending on education and healthcare, and really sort of this initiative and a vision of what's called the national development, a national development project that could help develop African industry, build diverse economies. There was an approach called import substitutionism and so on. And really, the idea was to break African economies away from models that were very much tied, like as under the colonial period, to just pulling resources out of the ground and shipping them away. And so there was an attempt and a goal, essentially, to do that. The problem is that these newly emerging African nations were not able to extricate themselves from the larger dynamics of the world economy. And so in the early 1970s, in the course of a global economic crisis, these African economies, as elsewhere in the global, and really elsewhere in the world, experienced a severe crash. And this growth gave way to stagnation and decline. And African economies were faced with, on the one hand, deep recessions, and on the other hand, relatively weak states. I mean, again, these were very new nations, which really set them up on both counts to the imperial interference and meddling, and essentially where the World Bank and the IMF were presented as essentially the only solution. So what's called structural adjustment, and then a debt crisis that was created at that time by the World Bank and the IMF, and in which debt repayment was accompanied by requirements for privatization, disinvestment from social programs, disbanding of unions, regulation, austerity, and deindustrialization. So here's where a lot of the groundwork for the extraction kind of moment that we're in now is late because these conditionalities also demanded that investment be limited to a very narrow range of primary commodities. Again, echoing back to the colonial era, where you have commodities that were geared for export and undermined any aspirations of more diverse economic growth and national development and so on. So these are, I would argue, among the most crucial conditions that have laid the groundwork for the boom today. So what you see now in countries such as Angola, South Sudan, and others, where you have export revenue is 95, even 98% based on the export of oil and so on. This is an incredibly unstable situation and doesn't exist certainly in the Western or industrialized world. So where am I at for time? 14. Okay, great. So I'll just give, I don't want to bog people down with a lot of details, but just to give like a couple examples. So for example, like Ivory Coast, which was, which in the 60s was sort of seen as kind of like a young, strong, emerging economy in Africa, was forced to just slash tariffs. It destroyed its manufacturing industry. Textile industries, which were very strong in places like Nigeria and Zambia, were by the 1990s were a tenth of what they had been in the 60s and 70s. Requirements to loosen capital controls meant that capital flight, that corporations could just pull their money out, as well as the African ruling class. And there's estimates of about $1 trillion has been lost from the African continent to capital flight. Things like civil tax collection, environmental enforcements were forced to be weakened. And this is, again, if you look at, like, for the picture on the cover of my book is an oil spill in Nigeria. So what happened was, countries were basically forced to, to get rid of all their environmental regulatory processes and so on. So you have places like the Niger Delta, which are among the most polluted spots on the globe. So there's lots of other examples. People can ask questions about this, but the bottom line is that an important kind of outcome of this is that not only was massive amounts of debt incurred, but the conditions in which these were imposed set African nations back, but also meant that African nations were repaying many times more back to these Western financial institutions. So this spelled, for people who are familiar with the work of, for example, David Harvey, Eric Toussaint, and so on, and just in general about this period, probably familiar that this is a dynamic that happened all over the global South, in which there was a neoliberal global program to really open up markets and create conditions that were favorable for Western investment. And this hit particularly hard in Africa, also Latin America and Asia as well, and was really a catastrophe for the world's working classes and poor people. So what I find important to emphasize is that tends to be a small L liberal idea that Africa has been neglected, and to some extent that's true, but in another sense, Africa has been actively deindustrialized, has been actively stripped of its resources and exploited. So just as in the past with the extraction of resources and the processes really highlighted some of these contradictions, I mean, that's very much still true today, where the mineral wealth that's found under the ground in places like, for example, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is just has the world's largest supply of coltan used to make cell phones, places like Zambia, which has the largest supply of copper, or maybe second to Australia, I believe, and so on. Alongside of that, you've got massive unemployment, poverty. Now there's, the DRC has had decades-long regional wars where millions of people have died, outbreaks of Ebola, for example, that have gone untreated. There is, it's a barbaric, insane set of conditions where this immense wealth existing alongside of such devastation and poverty. And large, In addition, despite all this this kind of massive influx of investment by China and by the West, actually it's measurable that African nations have their level of industrialization has reversed. That there is, despite, for example, there's been huge investments in power plants. Barack Obama was really interested in power investment and generation in Africa. 635 million Africans don't have electricity today. Poverty has actually increased during this period when this sort of new boom, this new scramble for Africa. 100 million Africans were living in poverty in 2012 than they were just 10 years earlier. So I want to say a little bit quickly about the African ruling classes, though, because I think that there's an important piece of this to understand, that the class polarization that may not have been as sharp in Africa at the time of independence, through this process has become quite sharp. And there's been growth not only in and the wealth of the section of African elites, but also growth of things like the African stock markets and so on. Okay, thank you. And so on. And this is there's sort of a debate on the left, I think, about what role elites in global South play, and I think it'd be a good thing to take up in the discussion. Is this a process of neocolonialism, or are African ruling classes, for example, which I would argue they're enthusiastic, although junior partners of global capital, but I think have their own aspirations for capital accumulation within their own borders. They're constrained by this neoliberal and colonial history that I mentioned, but at the same time, they are not just sort of serving the dictates and the lieutenants of the imperial powers. And they, in other words, they have their own particular objectives. So and some that's going to vary across the continent, where some particularly resource rich countries have more leverage than others. There's a brand new African free trade agreement where the African rulers are trying to sort of, you know, marshal together some of their forces and so on. It's also important, I think, to emphasize that this neoliberal project did not then go on and benefit only the West, that China has been able to benefit from the, as sort of a late arrival, has been able to step in and kind of elevate itself or project itself into this situation. So now we have really, I think, an actual inter-imperial rivalry that's playing out on this continent. And as you know, people I'm sure are familiar with Lenin and Bukharin's explanation of the classical theory of imperialism, where with economic competition spilling over into conflicts over markets and as well access to resources, both military and otherwise. But Marxism also, and Trotsky wrote about this quite a bit, describes imperialism as a process of combined and uneven development. And I think that's a very useful framework to look at Africa in this way. African states and ruling classes are combined into the global capitalist system, but unevenly and not on the same basis as the major powers. So part of what I think is important with the current inter-imperial... Inter-imperial rivalry is a vast militarization that's beginning to spread. And I was at the session just before this on Australia and China and imperialism, which was really excellent, that talked about this, in which there's really been, on both sides, both China and the U.S. in particular, a rapid growth in the militarization of the African continent. Barack Obama was actually one of the big real sort of champions and escalated or accelerated this. And so virtually, and this was really done under the sort of cover of the war on terror. So virtually in every African nation, you've got some level of U.S. military presence, whether it's, you know, a drone base or all the way to, you know, a major, you know, military operation and so on. And this has The dynamic of the economic competition with China has actually facilitated both a growth in this militarization on the part of the U.S., but also for China as well. And so where China's stakes economically have raised and deepened, so too is the, you know, the need to have a certain amount of military might to back that up. The Belt and Road Initiative, which is, you know, valued or estimated to be about $1 trillion worldwide, the aspect of that which is going to encompass Africa, you could argue, I think rightfully, that the infrastructure footprint that has been laid out over the past decade and a half has formed the kind of basis for now which they can more easily insert themselves into a military presence. The first Chinese military base outside of China is in Djibouti, which is a very small nation on the Horn of Africa, which is really where they're butting up right against the U.S. military base there. And there's also France and I think Italy. There's a couple other nations that have bases there. So it's a highly militarized part of the world. China also is a major exporter of arms to Africa, along with Russia and a couple other nations as well. Russia has a huge military presence in Africa. So, I think that just to sort of say really quickly that, and there is, especially in the left, in the U.S. on the left, and there's a debate with among some, particularly there's a sort of new kind of neo-dependency school and so on, or particularly, or even just a confusion around the role of China. I would argue that China is not a gentler, kindler imperial force, but really has a similar project of imperialism and is reproducing class inequality and exploitation on the continent in the same way. Not in the same way, but with similar objectives. Now, last year, Trump has said he's going to reduce the overall operations of the U.S. in Africa, but he's being more strategic about it. He's put a lot of focus into targeting so-called Islamic militants, such as Boko Haram in Nigeria and Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which is, again, on the Horn of Africa, very strategically important across the water from the Middle East and so on, and near that, the drone war that the U.S. has been carrying out in Somalia, which is not very well known. Amnesty International just released a report on this, I think it was about a month and a half ago, that the amount that we don't know about the extent of the drone war is massive, and probably the number of civilians that have been killed undoubtedly in the thousands, and the American military has admitted nothing about this. So, how am I for time? Oh, wow, this is great. Okay. So just to sort of say that and to close out this piece, which is that it's no argument, I imagine, with anyone here, but both U.S. and Chinese imperialism have made the African continent a more dangerous and unstable place, and I think that those trends are continuing to deepen, particularly with the posture that Trump has taken and the role that or the direction that Chinese imperialism has taken on the continent. So, in a couple of years ago, in 2016, so we've had this period of massive investment and boom in commodities and so on. A couple of years ago in 2016, commodity prices crashed worldwide, and this there was a glut of oil and raw materials on the market. There's a lot to say about that and about the role of, for example, Saudi Arabia, OPEC, and so on, and what was going on with oil prices. But it created a major crisis in oil-producing nations in Africa as well as around the world, and I think really is described well by what Marxists call crisis of overproduction and overcapacity in the world system. And this is, of course, typical of the boom and bust cycles of capitalism itself. And I think just really highlights the volatility of economies that are built on commodities where a collapse can just send shockwaves through sections of the system. So what happened was that It's set about a new round of indebtedness for African nations, both to the World Bank and the IMF, and also in terms of money that was now owed to China. And I think that the point that I think is important for us for on the left is for us to sit, to see that these dynamics are, create incredibly volatile and contradictory situations, that imperialism is both the military presence, but also the way in which the capitalist economy and the market is set up to be so unstable and so volatile and distorted that, that whole nations go lurch into recession with the drop of commodity prices and so on, which are unavoidable in a system built on competition and profit. So but also I think on a more positive note or a different note, it raises the question for the left in Africa and for us to consider here is what are the solutions to this? And so just to talk a little bit about that. So Africa, I'm sure some of you are aware, has a long tradition of struggle, the mass movements against colonialism, driven by millions of workers and peasants, really, shattered the control of a European colonial control over the continent. And as I talked about earlier, though, these new emerging African economies, okay, great, thank you, were hobbled by in colonialism and fell increasingly behind. At the same time, these new nationalist elites were really forced into the mold that all ruling classes face, which is become exploiters of workers and peasants and driven by international competition, despite aspirations to the contrary. So there were, for example, like African socialist regimes in Ghana and Tanzania, which were sources of inspiration, but in hindsight also revealed the weaknesses of this particular model and of a top-down national development approach, and what I would argue is the impossibility of delinking from the capitalist system. And this was a theory that was kind of put forward in the 70s, dependency theories and so on that were popular at this time, that argued that, for example, Pan-African vision or others, that the goal for the global south is to delink from the world market. And I think, unfortunately, the actual real life history of those parts of the world shows the challenges to that. Leo Zelig, who is a socialist who's written a number of books about Africa, and a biography of Frantz Fanon, which is brilliant, people should check it out, kind of posed this question, which I'll just read this quote by him. He says, "Why did a wider politics beyond independence not emerge? The emergent African working class engaged in anti-colonial struggles was relatively small, without a developed ideological position. It emerged into a political context dominated by both nationalism and a Stalinist form of communism that saw political progress in distinct stages, with the question of socialism entirely postponed until after the transition to democracy was complete." So, in other words, despite the courageous and immense continent-wide struggles again of workers, peasants, and students in overthrowing colonialism, there were significant historical barriers. And the subordination of their struggles to the project of national development and accumulation undermined or posed severe challenges to the building of independent trade unions, independent movements, and then following on that, the disciplining of the African working class that I described earlier by the international financial institutions. But nonetheless, powerful movements have continued despite these challenges. Powerful movements have risen up and have shaken African regimes to their to their roots. Over 36 dictatorial regimes have been toppled by struggles, were brought down by struggles from below in the 1990s alone. That decade saw multi-party elections held for the first time in a generation, and there were revolts against the IMF, against structural adjustment, and so on across the continent. Strikes against wage cuts, mobilizations for AIDS treatments, against privatization of water, electricity, debt relief, and many of those struggles laid the basis for the alliances and potential organization that continue down into this day. Obviously, it's worth lifting up and emphasizing the defeat of apartheid by South African, the South African working class in 1994, where workers with their hands on the most valuable minerals in the world showed the potential for working class struggle to unify radical and revolutionary demands and give leadership to the resistance of the oppressed groups in that region. So along those lines, I would say that today's new scramble for Africa, that African workers are likewise potentially positioned to battle exploitation because of their close ties to international capital and the potential for resistance and linking resistance between the global South and the global North. There's some on the left, like people may have heard of Mike Davis, wrote a book called Planet of Slums, where there's he expresses really a deep pessimism for the ability of workers, for example, in Africa and elsewhere in the global South, to overcome deep entrenched poverty and to and unemployment, and that essentially that workers are sort of dislodged from their revolutionary potential. But I would argue that this is a very narrow understanding of the dynamics of class struggle in the global South, that that as just elsewhere, as elsewhere in the world, African working classes are uneven, they're employed, unemployed, informally employed, et cetera, but that the potential for these struggles to coalesce as a liberatory class across, you know, diverse interests and so on, I think speaks to what I was mentioning earlier, that notion of combined and uneven development, where different working classes are inserted into and connected in, under capitalism as a whole. So it's not necessarily, and this is the part I think people like Mike Davis miss, it's not necessarily just the size of the working class, but it's also, or its weight, but it's about the political leadership that and the role that it plays in struggles as a whole. So just to get back to some of what we've seen over the past few months, the situation in Sudan, I think, is very exciting, but also very dynamic, that where you had, on the one hand, you know, very sort of vigilant working classes and so on that have actually been able to, their influence and so on and pull have seeped into sections of the military where low, you know, soldiers and so on unwilling to put down the protest and so on, coming up against a sort of, you know, a military body at the top of society that does not want to relinquish control. And I think that this is we'll sort of see how this plays out, and the military's current resistance to hand over and give in to the demand for civilian rule. Now, what it's part of what kicked this off was that the food prices and fuel prices had shot way up over the past couple of months, and this is in large part due to some of the dynamics around extraction that I described earlier. The Sudanese economy has been hit very hard because of South Sudan, which seceded in 2011, meant that Sudan lost about 75% of its oil revenue, which is created a severe crisis. And then as the civil war with South Sudan, or within South Sudan, has wound, continued, it put a chokehold on Sudan's revenue streams as well, as on top of which sanctions imposed by the U.S. in the name of counterterrorism. So Sudan is about $50 billion in debt. The currency has lost 85% of its value, and 13% of the population is facing crisis levels of hunger. So that's a huge that's a pretty devastating condition. So this is really this is really kind of what's underlying this. The military kind of leadership that's attempting to hold on to power right now is sort of sitting precariously, I think, and is not going to be able to obviously step in and shift those conditions decisively. So I think that our ongoing solidarity and so on will be, you know, is very important, and to sort of continue to lift up the strength of the working class there and what it's been able to accomplish. Similarly, I'm just going to highlight a couple of key areas I mentioned before. In South Africa, there's an election that's coming up, and this hugely wealthy South African ruling class has continued to has failed in a devastating way to deliver to South African workers and poor people who brought down apartheid, and housing and public services are at a shocking level, really similar to under apartheid, and some of the biggest protests that have been seen in decades are now on the streets in parts of South Africa. Zimbabwe as well, there was a general strike in January, and which, again, acute shortages, huge inflation and unemployment. The ISO in Zimbabwe, the International Socialist Organization, wrote a report on this, and they which I'll just read from, that says the suffering Zimbabweans have gone further not just stay away, but demonstrated in the townships and cities of Zimbabwe against deindustrialization and growing economic crisis. No manufacturing is taking place in the country, as the country has been reduced to a supermarket selling products produced in other countries. The country has not been spared from globalization's effects, and this has been worsened by Mnangagwa's open for business that is seeing the extraction of raw materials at low prices and imported back at high prices. So this is the written by comrades in Zimbabwe, and okay, great, who are identified, the dynamic that's playing out across the continent. At the same time, there is there's just immense struggle that's happening, or not at the same time. There is really exciting struggles and political developments. There's a new party that was launched by the metal workers in South Africa. It's called the Revolutionary Socialist Workers Party. They had a general strike, a national strike last year, which I was really fortunate to be there and to witness, and which essentially the whole country was shut down for about a day. I also went to a protest that for a campaign against actually an Australian titanium company called the MRC, which has been attempting to displace the Zolobeni community in the Eastern Cape for about 10 years. And this community has been able to dig in, and to the slogan of their campaign is, "We have the right to say no." And so when I was there, I was able to go to the court case. The community had brought the Australian titanium miners to court, and to witness that, you know, their struggle and so on. And I can talk, if people want to know more information about that, since it is an Australian company. It's a really inspiring, and there's actually a movie about this too. So I think I pretty much have start to wrap up. There's many more examples that I could give where I think struggle is very, has started to, you know, there's the left is grappling with some important questions, and struggle is developing. I just want to sort of say that I think that for us as socialists and radicals and progressives, that just to kind of end with really centering the idea of internationalism and solidarity and the Marxist notion of permanent revolution. What I mean by that is that this idea that the necessity of our struggles to be linked, and the need for revolution to really continue to grow and to move beyond borders and so on, and in particular for us to take stock of the importance of struggles such as in Africa, which we don't sometimes in the global north are not as familiar with, and the ability of that of self-determination and so on, that of working class and poor people there. And just as in, you know, African societies, they have a left that are grappling with a lot of the same kinds of questions that we're grappling with in our different movements. How do we build revolutionary struggles across all of society? How do we go beyond and pose a direct challenge to capital worldwide? And so I think it's probably obvious to most of us, but really our struggles are global. The challenge to us, whether it's Australian, U.S., Chinese capital, and that are waging war on their workers at home, are also the same companies exploiting African workers that are clamoring to militarize their continent, to devastate their communities and pollute them. And this must be, I think, our starting point, the urgency of that solidarity and anti-imperialism everywhere, and potential for a world to win.